You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, May 29th, 2026. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week on the show, we're sharing an interview from Rabble's Book Lounge. Emil Niazi joins Rabble publisher Sarah Sahagian to talk about her new book, Life After Ambition, a Good Enough Memoir. The two also discuss what it means to be a millennial and mother in the times we're living in. We'll be sharing the first 20 minutes of their conversation on the podcast today. To listen to the full interview, visit Rabble's Patreon. The link to do so is in the show notes of this episode, or for all of you radio listeners, simply visit patreon.com/rabble. Here are Sarah Sahagian and Emil Niazi in conversation. Take a listen.
Hi, Emil Niazi. Welcome to Rabble Radio.
Great to be here.
So we're here to talk about your new memoir, Life After Ambition. If you were to give us an elevator pitch for Life After Ambition, what would that pitch be?
It's about the intersection of motherhood, personhood, life as a millennial, and ambition and work, and how that relationship and those factors evolve over time. We were sold a bill of goods as kids, and we followed the path to success that was laid out for us, discovered it was a lie, and then what do you do once you have discovered that lie? You have to figure out a way to move on. You have to figure out life after ambition.
So I read your book and you have a life trajectory that many millennials living in Canada have, and I think could relate to. So your family immigrated when I think you're about five in the book from the UK, and your parents had also immigrated previously to that. So you come here, you start in Toronto, you end up in Vancouver. So you've lived in two major metropolitan centers in Canada. And then you have a lot of those classic millennial jobs, working at The Gap, promoting clubs, I think, at one point.
Yeah, I was a flyer girl.
Yeah, the flyer girl work, a lot of those classic types of jobs. So I'm just curious. So we at Rabble talk a lot about late capitalism, late stage capitalism. When did you have that moment where you realized that we were not in a meritocracy that you've been sold, right? And you talk about that in the book, about how you thought, if I just worked hard enough, right, I could escape poverty, I could achieve my dreams, all of these different goals. When did you realize that this was a lie, that this was a late capitalist lie?
You know what? It was deep into my first like real grown-up job working in media. You know, I don't want to say where, but a big company. And you know, the trajectory was very much laid out for me there. It was like you start sort of at the bottom as like a junior producer, and then you work your way up. And hopefully at the, I guess the end goal was to like be an exec of a show or, you know, to be like a boss. And I was doing everything right as far as I knew. You know, I was someone who worked really hard. I stayed late. I did a great job. I knew that I was someone who was contributing to every single place that I worked within that corporation. But then I was told, oh, you know, you're not right for this because X, we loved you, but this. And then I would watch these like far more mediocre, usually white men rise above me. And I was like, what's the difference between us? You know, because as far as I know, I'm training that person to do the job that they're doing because I've been doing it, but now, but I'm not good enough to actually be paid for that position, but you trust me to do the job. And that's when I realized it's like, oh, what, they went to the right school, or, oh, you know, they sort of like speak that secret language that certain people speak. And so that was when I was like, okay, this is, the whole thing is rigged, and like, why? It was a bit of a why bother moment, but I'm someone that can't just stop, you know, I couldn't fall back into complacency. So I just kept working harder and harder. And I thought maybe if I just moved to a different part of the corporation, maybe if I just had a female boss, maybe this, maybe that. And it just, no, life is not fair, unfortunately. And I found out maybe a little bit too late.
What would you have done differently? So I know when you write a memoir, you have to reflect on a lot of different things. If you had known this, I'm just curious, do you think after writing the memoir, because it details so much of your life from childhood to, you know, motherhood to, you know, your current moment, where do you think you might have made a different decision, if any at all?
Well, that's the thing. I guess sometimes I wish like I had gone to school for something more tactile and tangible and real, you know, like I should have been a doctor, or I should have been a plumber, or, you know, I just should have had a real life applicable skill rather than like, oh, I have good ideas sometimes. Like I can craft a sentence, you know, apparently AI can do that. But on the other hand, I love my life and I love my family and I love where I've ended up and I love my community and I genuinely love what I do. And so you do, reflecting back, hopefully tell yourself, yes, there were a lot of mistakes. Yes, I have regrets. But on the other hand, I wouldn't change a thing because I really do like where I ended up. So even though I wish I'd gone to medical school, I'm happy that I'm doing what I do. And, you know, to be honest, I probably would have been a doctor that was like, I sure wish I was writing right now.
You'd be maybe you'd be that guy who told Margaret Atwood he was going to write when he retired, and she said, I'm going to do brain surgery when I retire.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. The hubris.
No, I mean, honestly, I think a lot of millennials can relate to that. You know, when you graduate into an economic crisis and then there's just constantly economic crises, right? You have children during COVID, all of these different things. You can kind of relate to thinking, you know, I wish I could just be a carpenter, because being a carpenter is great. It takes a lot of skill. You get to build a table. It's wonderful. And people will always need tables. AI can't replace me. I mean, maybe one day they'll make AI robots that can make a table, but not right now.
Apparently, one of the hardest things for these robots to do are those kinds of like laundry and build, like, you know, working with their hands. That, so, you know, yes, carpenters are probably pretty safe. I mean, I just wrote about this for The Cut, midlife crisising in the end times, and you know, it was the most read article on The Cut for 2 days. So obviously, it's relatable to people. And one of the central themes of the piece is just how bleak everyone feels right now about not just the economy and the state of the world, but just the future in general. Like it, I think it's the first time, despite all the crises we've lived through, and obviously as millennials, we've lived through a lot of really like world disrupting times.
Yeah.
The future has never felt so hard and dark. You know, even in 2008, graduating into that, or starting our jobs in that moment, I still had hope for the future. Like I still believed that, this is something that we could overcome and I could overcome. And I felt that about, you know, everything, every crisis we've lived through. But this feels different. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because after reading your book and having this conversation, I'm wondering if there is a correlation between ambition and just hope and resiliency. And maybe if we've just been through so much as a generation that we're just sort of like, screw grit. I just can't be resilient anymore. Because I have days, and I mean, I don't want to speak for you. I definitely have days when I feel that way, where I feel like, you know, I've proven I can be resilient. I want to stop proving it. I have that skill. I just don't want to. I think it's unfair that I have to do it again.
Yeah. Oh, yes. No, absolutely. I have those days. I mean, that's, again, one of the big points in the book, and also in this piece, is like, not again, that sense of like, not again, you know, I feel like as a generation, we have just sort of started to get our footing. You know, many of us are having kids, or, you know, maybe getting into the real estate ladder for the first time. Like, you know, we've been doing our jobs for a while. Hopefully we feel a little bit secure in the skills that we have, and to have it all disrupted and for nothing, you know, it feels like this moment is also like a completely manufactured crisis that these tariffs didn't need to exist. Yeah. These wars don't need to exist. Mm-hmm. You know, this AI bubble that no one wants AI, but it's being forced down our throats. Mm-hmm. It's like none of this needs to happen. And yet it is happening to us again. And I think we're tired. I'm mm-hmm. tired. You know, I just would love nothing more than a nice, stable job that I go to every day that they promise I'll have until I'm ready to stop working. And I'll probably mm-hmm. work mm-hmm. until I die, like most of us. So, I think we're tired. As a generation, we are tired.
And it's funny because I think probably previous generations, I guess they felt that way, but also the world wasn't changing as quickly. So you kind of could get used to what life would be like, you know, and previous generations definitely suffered. I mean, working in a coal mine, things like that, awful, awful, but you did know what was coming. There wasn't the uncertainty. There wasn't this fear that it would constantly get worse. That's sort of one interesting difference in history, I think. And I mean, people also just had more connections. Like as awful as an event like World War II was, I'm always struck by in the Blitz in London, if you go to museums of Britain, they'll show you what it was like. And people were hanging out in bomb shelters singing songs. They were terrified for their lives, but they had community. Yeah. And I'm not trying to glamorize that at all because it was a horrible historical moment. But we just, if we were in a bomb shelter together today, I don't think we have enough practice forming community to make it that kind of a beautiful, bittersweet moment.
Well, I mean, I actually disagree. I think, I think that community is one of the last mm-hmm. things that our generation has been good at building. I think Gen Zs, for example, and Gen mm-hmm. Alphas and these sort of disconnected, very mm-hmm. online generations would struggle much more than we would. Because, you know, we have existed in a time where there were no cell phones. There certainly mm-hmm. weren't smartphones, mm-hmm. social media, you know, we have experienced going out mm-hmm. or going to a concert and no mm-hmm. one's taking pictures, or it's mm-hmm. on a digital camera and it'll be uploaded maybe mm-hmm. in a couple of months, maybe not. You know, we've existed outside the panopticon, and I don't think the younger generations know about what it, you know, that feeling of real life connection and building community and how important it is mm-hmm. in the same way that they do experience that on the internet. So In that instance, I actually do think we were pretty good at that, but I don't want to sing in a bomb shelter for sure. Like I don't, but you know what, back to like what you were saying about the predictability of life before, like mm-hmm. I do think now if you were to ask, you know, someone our age, like, you know, what's your 5-year plan? Most of us wouldn't really be able to tell you what our job situation will be like mm-hmm. in 5 years.
So I'm just curious, as a mother, just as a person in the world, how do you talk to younger generations about the future, given that we don't know what it holds?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. You know, obviously, as a parent, one of the, I think, mm-hmm. prerequisites is that I have optimism, right? It's an mm-hmm. optimistic thing. It's a hopeful thing to have a child because you are mm-hmm. believing and investing in the future and in their future mm-hmm. and in your future. Mm-hmm. And so I do, you know, I treat it as though everything is full steam ahead and life is going to be mm-hmm. as it was for me, because what else can I do really? You know, I don't know what's ahead. I can only give them the skills to adapt to whatever mm-hmm. comes next. So I am trying to teach them to be adaptable, to be hopeful, to be mm-hmm. optimistic, to be resilient, to really just be a good person, because I think that ultimately, whatever comes next, they have to be someone who can contribute to the community. And those skills are, I think, evergreen and, you know, things that our own parents, I think, wanted to mm-hmm. instill as well. And the things that I won't do, I think, are the things that our parents did. I try not to focus on this idea that, mm-hmm. you know, just get good grades and go to university mm-hmm. and life will be laid out for you. I'm not going to give them empty promises mm-hmm. and I'm not going to tell them that the world is necessarily a fair place and that, mm-hmm. you know, you are mm-hmm. promised a certain type of future. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's sad also, you know, I think that that's, there is a kind of a a sense of safety in, mm-hmm. in wanting to tell them like, yes, go, you know, go have a great time at university, study what mm-hmm, you want, mm-hmm. pursue your dreams. I think I get why our parents mm-hmm. did that, but I also don't want them to face that same disappointment. There's going to be many other disappointments in their lives. They don't need to have that one. And hope that's the lesson I think I took mm-hmm. from writing the book is like, I feel and many people in my generation, our generation, had been set up to fail, really. Yeah. And so I would love for them to avoid that specific heartbreak because, you know, there'll be many other types of heartbreaks.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head that it is a heartbreak to avoid. It is interesting. I was reading about how different, I mean, it's just sort of theory about, anthropological theory about class systems and how different classes reproduce the class that they are in or mm-hmm. Instill a certain ethos, right? And how a lot of middle class and upper middle class children are raising these kind of worker bees, right? With the five co-curriculars a week and just raising yeah. these exhausted children who never have fun and are told if you just work hard, literally from the day they're two when they start their co-curriculars, like yeah. you will succeed. And it strikes me that given that we don't know if that's true, it's such an interesting way that to parent, and we're still parenting that way. We still see the intensive parenting. We're parenting kids to be workaholics who might not even have a job to step into in 20 years.
Exactly. No, like I think the tiger mom mm-hmm. kind of stereotype, it feels very much like of a different era and mm-hmm. age, you know, and even this, the hustle and grind culture, mm-hmm. the girl boss, like I mm-hmm. do think even Gen Zs see the problem in that type mm-hmm. of motivation mm-hmm. and that type of worker. And they don't even want that for their lives, you know, and they yeah. don't want their workplaces yeah. Yeah. to be promoting that type of lifestyle because mm-hmm. it's so exhaustive and you're, mm-hmm. it's destined to burn you out. But it's very difficult, I think, to parent or even for your own self to imagine mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. the future these days, because we really don't have a clear mm-hmm. sense politically, culturally, mm-hmm. economically, what it's going to look like. Mm-hmm. And like, that feels different to me, but also I don't know, because maybe it's just middle age. Maybe this is what it's like to be 40 years old, right? The first 40 years of our life are going to look very, very different from the next 40 years of our life, if we live that long.
It is so interesting. I was reflecting the other day, somebody like, I for work, this is so random, I had to research Dwight Eisenhower, who was born mm-hmm. in 1890, before airplanes existed. And then in World War II, he's in charge of D-Day, and he, you know, there's the Air Force, that's how they win, right, and all these things. And then he becomes president, and before he dies, the U.S. lands on the moon. And you just sort of think, in the modern era, the pace of change has become so much faster, right? Like, you've got one person who is born, no airplanes. Teenager, airplanes. Mm-hmm. In his adulthood, I'm in charge of this huge army and we have airplanes. It's just interesting to think about how just in the modern era, starting with the 20th century, it really becomes hard to predict the future. And I don't know if previous generations were as aware of how quickly quickly the world was changing. But as you said, I think that there is now a huge awareness that we might not even have humanity as we know it, right? So previously we were sort of, the question was, what kind of technology will humanity use? And now the question is, will humanity exist or will AI mm-hmm. replace us?
Mm-hmm. Or yes, AI, climate change, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like I think when I worked at the BBC, mm-hmm. there was a really, really big push on, mm-hmm. you know, on sustainability and, mm-hmm. and education about climate change mm-hmm. as being something that was like built into the programming because it's such an important mm-hmm. issue. And at one point, there was someone who came in to sort of educate us as commissioners on climate change. And he was essentially mm-hmm. saying, like, you know, you think about it like storms and mm-hmm. that got, you know, that doc from Al Gore, but yeah. it's going to be mass displacement, mass mm-hmm. unemployment, mass mm-hmm. immigration and food crises and water crises. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we're also not realistically preparing for. And mm-hmm, that's something mm-hmm. that's been looming over us in our entire lives. And it's so obvious that for our kids, the world is not going to look the same. And that's really scary. And again, the last talking to a friend mm-hmm. about this, I was like really lamenting all of these things. And he was like, okay, well, So the last 40 years of our life will be really hard and bad, but we'll still be there and we'll make it work. And I was like, dude, that sucks. Like, that really sucks. The one thing we might have been able to look forward to is like retiring and, you know, having grandkids and doing just those things. And now you're telling me it's like, I have to fight in the Hunger Games. Like when I'm 60 and 70 years old, it just, and that's obviously doom and gloom and maybe things will be fine and whatever, but there is a sense of hopelessness that I think we're experiencing as a generation. And maybe this is just like a global feeling and it's pan generation, but it's acutely felt, I think, amongst millennials.
Yeah. And I've noticed the attitude millennials have to misfortune is very different. It's pretty fatalistic that people aren't even outraged. The millennial generation is funny because when we were younger, everyone said we were so entitled. I actually think it's one of the least entitled generations in history. Everyone got degrees they didn't need in order to do jobs that didn't really want them, worked overtime. I remember in my 20s, I usually had about like 7 jobs at any given time, just so desperate to prove myself. And so I actually feel like...
That was the first 20 minutes of Emile's interview with Sarah. The full interview is available on Rabble's Patreon. Join at any level to listen. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's hand things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting with national news. The review deadline for the Canada-US-Mexico Free Trade Agreement is rapidly approaching as tensions between Canada and the US continue to rise. The US and Mexico have already begun their bilateral negotiations for their part of the deal, but US trade representatives have continued to criticize Canada for being, quote, difficult. US trade representatives have repeatedly raised issue after issue with Canada, greatly delaying any progress in the talks. Most recently, the U.S. government has been critical of Canada's Online News Act and Online Streaming Act, which favor Canadian-made content. The free trade deal covers a wide range of goods that are exempt from tariffs, and allowing the deal to expire could lead to economic hardship on both sides of the border. However, even if the deal is extended, the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has said that tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum would still stay in place. Staying with national news, Prime Minister Mark Carney continues to put forward policies that favor the wealthy and corporations over the environment and poorer Canadians. One of his first acts as Prime Minister was to repeal a modest increase to the capital gains tax that was introduced by his predecessor, Justin Trudeau. That tax would have only affected the wealthiest Canadians and primarily only those who traded in the stock market. More recently, Carney has shown himself to be even more pro-business and anti-environment with his approach to pipelines. This week, Carney met with Alberta Premier Danielle Smith to discuss how to continue moving forward with a project for a new oil pipeline. Rival parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg writes that Carney's supporters justify his moves to the right by saying that they are necessary as long as Canada faces a threat from U.S. President Donald Trump. Nirenberg writes, quote, "Unprecedented threats, the Carney folks say, mean the government must make tough choices. We cannot afford to favor the environment, Indigenous rights, or the expansion of the social safety net as we thought we could in the Justin Trudeau era," end quote. Also this week, in a column shared with Rabble, Linda McQuaig writes that Carney's attempts to appease Alberta will not win him any political points in that province. McQuaig sees Carney's support of an oil pipeline in Alberta as an attempt to counter separatist activism in the province, but she does not believe that would work. She points out that Justin Trudeau bought the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion after no private company would invest in the project, and that Albertans still hated Trudeau despite that. As well, McQuaig argues that Alberta separatists will always be motivated to be combative with Ottawa. Alberta separatists are motivated by corporate interests and funded through foreign influence, primarily from the U.S. For these reasons, she believes, Alberta separatists will never view Ottawa or Mark Carney in a favorable light. In labor news this week, more than 100 unionized workers employed by the Mama Earth Organics grocery store and delivery company in Toronto have lost their jobs. The news comes after the company announced it was moving outside of Toronto to nearby Mississauga. The workers were unionized with the United Food and Commercial Workers, and their collective agreement required the company to keep on any employees if Mama Earth Organics changed locations, but that agreement only applied to the City of Toronto. For its part, the company says that it is moving due to the high cost of rent at its current location. Mama Earth Organics said that some of its employees will be employed at their new location, but acknowledged that not all of their current staff were willing or able to make the commute. In other news this week, Rabble columnist Lois Ross argues that a public option for groceries could be an effective way to combat rising food prices. The idea was one of Avi Lewis's signature promises in his campaign for the NDP leadership. Ross notes that grocery prices continue to rise. She lays the blame for rising food costs directly at the feet of large grocery stores. Five grocery chains have a near monopoly on the market in Canada. While their profits rise, so does the cost of food. Farmers are also being squeezed. They're having to bear the burdens of rising fuel costs while not seeing any real benefit of rising prices in grocery stores. In her column, Ross writes that a public option for groceries could also be comparatively cost-effective for the government as well. She writes that Canada is planning on buying new fighter jets. The cost of starting and maintaining a public option for groceries would cost less than half of the lifetime cost of just one of those new jets. And finally, in environmental news, Prime Minister Mark Carney has made increasing Canada's national defense budget one of his signature policies. But David Suzuki argues that protecting national security means also protecting the environment. As we've already discussed, Carney is pursuing a new oil pipeline in Alberta. He is also investing significant amounts of money into the military, which is a major polluter. Part of protecting the Arctic must also involve reducing global warming, and not just building more submarines. Likewise, protecting our national forests will also help to reduce carbon emissions and help fight climate change. As always, you can read the full versions of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick, and that's it for Rabble Radio this week. To help support our show, please visit rabble.ca/donate, subscribe to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and now join us over on Patreon for special bonus content. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Marenberg for supplying the music, and thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
listening to CJSF